I'm Marty Moscoway, and welcome to Radio Times. More than our counterparts living in Europe, Americans generally believe that if we work hard, we can succeed and that we can shape and control our own destinies. Translated more starkly, winners believe that winning is due to their talents and work ethic, and losers have only themselves to blame. Our guest Michael Sandel begs to differ because we don't all have an equal chance at the starting line. His new book, The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good, deconstructs this credo, this enduring American myth, finding that it has driven us apart, is reflected in our political divisions and growing income inequality. Sandel teaches political philosophy at Harvard, one of those elite universities that caters to the wealthy and the well-connected, and he joins us by Skype. Michael Sandel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Why do Americans believe so strongly in this idea of meritocracy?
There's something appealing about the idea that with effort and hard work, anyone can succeed. And there's something even more appealing about the idea that once we have succeeded, that we've earned it, that we deserve the rewards that flow from having landed on top. So that's powerfully appealing. It's connected to an ideal of freedom, that we are free human agents, self-making, and that we can make our destiny and be responsible for our fate. So it's an exhilarating ideal, Marty, but it also has a dark side, which is what I call the tyranny of merit as it's unfolded in recent decades.
And I want to pick up on that. I'm thinking about Americans, maybe more than our European counterparts or counterparts around the world, believe in our individualism or this idea of bootstraps. And there certainly are stories in this country of rags to riches, of people, you know, who did good because they did work hard.
Yeah, that's true. And we hold up those stories as examples, as inspirations of what's possible. And that inspiration is a good thing up to a point. It's a good thing provided it doesn't blind us to the fact that chances are not truly equal in America. And the ability to rise one generation to the next, the ability of a young person born to a poor family, able to rise to affluence or even the middle class, is actually harder. It's more difficult now in America than it is in many other countries, places like Denmark, Germany, Canada, even France. It's easier to rise from humble origins to affluence in a generation than it is in the United States. So the facts on the ground no longer support the ideal, the somewhat comforting ideal we've often told ourselves, which is that we don't need to worry about inequality as such, because in America, no one is consigned to the class of his or her birth. That isn't quite true anymore.
Was it ever true? Was there ever a kind of golden age in America where, you know, where hard work and talent could help an individual, you know, if not rise to the top, certainly rise out of poverty, perhaps into the middle class? Was there ever a golden age of that?
I don't know that there was a golden age, and we don't have hard economic data tracking social mobility going back historically, though there are some indications, some attempts to estimate this. But what's striking is the gap between the perceptions of possibilities of rising, which in America are very high. Surveys show that Americans, far more than Europeans, believe that with effort and hard work, it's possible to rise, to do it on one's own, much more so than in Europe. But paradoxically, in Europe, it's in many European countries that lack the faith in upward mobility, it's actually easier. And in the U.S., where we have a very widespread faith in the ability to rise one generation to the next, it's actually harder. So these surveys have found that Americans are more optimistic and Europeans more pessimistic about the actual chances of rising that prevail in our respective societies.
Even though the reality of people's lives would belie that?
Yes, and it's an interesting question why this is the case. And it shapes our response. The reason it matters to try to sort this out, I think, is it matters in shaping our political response to inequality. In recent decades, inequalities have deepened. And yet in American politics, the primary response to the deepening inequalities and to the wage stagnation of the last four decades has not been to confront those inequalities directly, but to offer instead the promise of individual upward mobility through higher education. You can make it if you try. What you earn will depend on what you learn. These are the slogans that politicians across the political spectrum have offered as a response to the deepening inequality of recent decades. And it's that response which is in the grip of the myth and the hope of upward mobility that I think distracts us and ill-equips us from dealing with inequality directly by saying, well, it's possible to escape.
Does it also explain, again, compared to our counterparts in Europe, that we have less generous social welfare programs in this country, fewer safety net programs, because we're supposed to make it by ourselves on our own?
Yes, I think that that's a very important point. And this is for two reasons. First, because we tell ourselves, we console ourselves, we don't need to worry so much about inequality and a robust safety net and welfare state because no one is stuck at the bottom or in hard circumstances. They can pull themselves up by their bootstraps. And there's another part of this, Marty, which is insofar as the successful believe that their success is their own doing, the measure of their merit, the more inclined they're also they are to believe that those who struggle, those who are left behind, must also be responsible for their fate. And so this combination of attitudes toward winning and losing, toward success, have contributed, I think, to a lesser sense of responsibility for the common good, for the whole. In this way, meritocracy, the faith in individual upward mobility through higher education, meritocracy is corrosive of the common good, of a sense of mutual responsibility for our fellow citizens.
Well, let me pick up on education, and even before getting to college, most people in this country do not have a bachelor's degree or a college education, but education, especially public education, was supposed to be the great equalizer. It was this, you know, wonderful American invention, is that everyone gets an education in this country and that will help them succeed. What do we have as a result of that?
It's true that public education, when it was conceived, was intended as a way, well, there were really two noble ideals in the advent of the common schools, the public school. One was to provide a level playing field, equal opportunity for everyone, especially at a time when aspiration and rising and success could be had with a secondary education, didn't require in earlier times a college education. But the public schools were also intended as a place that brought people together from different backgrounds, different class backgrounds, different backgrounds of faith and belief and ethnicity. And these are both noble ideals. But today, when there are great advantages to having a college education, this ideal of public education is inadequate, especially when public education is funded in a way by local property taxes in many places that leads to vast inequalities in the quality of public education that students receive.
Let me pick up on the fact that you teach at Harvard, you know, one of the elite Ivies, and you write that two-thirds of the students at Harvard, or I guess at other Ivy League colleges as well, come from the top 20% of the population. What does that tell us?
It tells us that despite generous financial aid policies, the Ivy League schools generally, and highly selective, well-endowed, colleges and universities in this country are not the engines of upward mobility that we often hope that they will be. Another striking figure is that if you look at the Ivy League colleges as a whole, there are more students from the top 1% of families in income terms than there are from the entire bottom half of the country combined. And so this suggests that the playing field for admission is not equal. Of course, everyone is free to take the same SATs and to submit grades and their various academic credentials. But in this country, the idea of meritocracy originally held out the promise that whatever your social background or economic background, you could compete on equal terms if you had talent for admission to top universities. But in fact, these very instruments, the SAT, for example, now reflect the economic backgrounds of the families from which students come. The higher the family income, the greater the likelihood of getting a high score on the SAT. So the inequalities begin far before college admission, and have to do with the ability now of well-off parents to, in effect, pass their advantages and their privileges onto their kids.
We have about a minute before our first break here. I want to quote something from your book about your students, and you write, "More and more of my students seem drawn to the conviction that their success is their own doing, a product of their effort, something they have earned. Among the students I teach, this meritocratic faith has intensified."
I think so. This does not mean they aren't deeply involved in public service and caring for others. But because they have to endure the stress-strewn, high-pressure, meritocratic gauntlet of the high school years that many well-off kids competing for admission have to endure, it's hard not to believe that their effort is what enabled them to land a place at a selective college or university. And this draws upon the meritocratic attitudes toward success, toward winning, that we see throughout our culture, throughout our public discourse. So it's no surprise that it shapes the understandings of today's college students of themselves.
And that is Michael J. Sandel, our guest on Radio Times today. We're talking about his new book. It's called The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. And you can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, Michael Sandel is our guest. He's got a new book called The Tyranny of Merit. We've got some folks who want to join us, but just a couple of follow-up questions. But a college education, and it should be said that most people do not go to an Ivy League college. I certainly didn't. I never would have been accepted, believe me. But at the same time, a college education, I guess if you can get past that student debt, is a ticket to a better job. I want to just sort of understand how you see what a college education can do for a person.
Ideally, a college education equips people for satisfying work, but also is an education in exploration, in reflection, to civic education. And one of my worries is that we have converted colleges and universities, higher education generally, into a vast sorting machine that is so bound up with allocating opportunity with defining the merit and conferring the credentials that a meritocratic society rewards, that this is distracting higher education, our colleges and universities, from the moral and civic education, from the liberal arts learning, from the intrinsic love of teaching and learning that ideally college education should be about. If I could just add one word, Marty, to the point you made about most people don't go to an Ivy League college. That's certainly true. But what we easily forget when we may, especially in politics, politicians who say, well, just go to college and then you can succeed and flourish. What we forget is that most Americans do not have a four-year college degree of any kind. In fact, nearly two-thirds do not, which is why I think, and I argue in the book, that a political appeal that deals with inequality by telling people to go get a college degree leaves out the majority of Americans. And that's why I think it contributes to generating some of the anger and resentment, sense of being looked down upon, that many people feel.
Let me throw something else out, and then we'll get some of our listeners in on the conversation. And, you know, all conversations lead to the pandemic these days. But obviously, the pandemic has revealed many divides in this country. We see who the essential workers are. We clap for them. We're told that we are all in this together. But I think almost a year later, we are learning and we see that we are not all in this together. How do you address that?
Yes. Well, I think that the I think this is very revealing, what we've seen with the pandemic. Those of us who have the luxury of working from home can't help but notice how deeply we depend on workers we often overlook. I'm thinking not only of those who are working in hospitals, for example, but warehouse workers, delivery workers, grocery store clerks, home health care providers, childcare workers. These are not the best paid and most honored workers in our societies. But now we're calling them, just as you say, Marty, essential workers. Right. So this could be an opening for a broader public debate about how to reconfigure our economy to bring their pay and recognition into better alignment with the importance of the work they do. We need a broader public debate than one that focuses only on individual rising through college education. And this could be an opening for a broader debate about the dignity of work and the importance of the contributions made by many workers, many citizens, despite their not having lustrous credentials from four-year college degrees.
Do you think we're at this moment? I'm thinking about how President Biden, you know, talks about the middle class and talks about opportunity. I mean, if you watched the inauguration, we could all watch it on TV. It was highlighting, you know, drivers and teachers and healthcare workers. Are we at this moment, or is this going to just pass us by?
I think that's an open question, Marty, but a very important one, because and the short answer is it's up to us, as well as to our elected officials and the new administration. But there is a subtle difference, though many people see Joe Biden's administration as a restoration or continuation of the Obama years and the Clinton-Obama years. There is a subtle difference. Just in the way that you've identified, during the campaign, he did talk, Biden did talk about the dignity of work, and he emphasized that. And he did not emphasize as much as previous Democratic candidates and presidents emphasized individual rising through getting a college education. Now, don't misunderstand me. Encouraging more people to go to college is a good thing.
Sure.
And broadening access for those who can't afford it, that's even better. What I'm arguing against is making that the primary political message and project, that the way to deal with the inequalities we face is simply to tell people, go get a college education. What's interesting about Joe Biden is that he is the first Democratic nominee for president in 36 years without an Ivy League degree. And this could enable him to connect with working people and to articulate a program emphasizing the dignity of work that goes beyond the rhetoric of rising, as I call it, the meritocratic rhetoric, the credentialist rhetoric that has dominated the public discourse of Democrats and Republicans in recent decades. So I think there is a possibility. We'll have to see whether he can develop and deepen that project and translate it into actual policies.
In fact, I just scribbled the word policy. So it's, I mean, if we're going to make this more of a reality, you need policies that look at taxes, that look at, you know, a living wage, that look at health care, all the look at education, student debt, all of that.
Yes. Yes. And including some debates that we have around the edges, but that we often don't debate explicitly in terms of affirming the dignity of work. Here's one example. You mentioned taxes, Marty.
Yeah.
One way of framing the kind of debate that I'm suggesting about the dignity of work and making it concrete rather than merely hortatory and rhetorical would be to ask about the structure of our tax system and to ask the question, why is it that we tax earnings from work, earnings from labor, at a higher rate than we tax earnings from dividends and interest and capital gains? Why is that? Now, we could debate that question from the standpoint of who bears the burden. Does the burden fall too much on those less able to afford it? And that's an important debate about fairness.
Right.
But we should also debate it, I think, from the standpoint of the value of affirming through our tax system the dignity of work and the social recognition we want to accord those who may be members of the working class without a college degree, but who are essential workers in the contributions they make. So what I'm suggesting is a reframing of our public discourse, including about taxes, to take this example, to connect our ideals with actual policies and practices.
Just a quick follow-up, and as you're talking, I'm thinking about the stock market has been going gangbusters while the pandemic has been essentially beating up the real economy.
Yes, and you're right. Going back to the point you made earlier, Marty, we applaud, we clap for essential workers, but we don't design an economy or a tax system that backs up that applause, that appreciation, very tangibly. And so we could reasonably ask, how do we want to value the various contributions to the common good that people in various jobs and social roles perform? Is it fair from that standpoint, the way the tax system treats, let's say, earnings from hedge funds by comparison with the earnings from the delivery people
Sure.
who enable many of us to avoid the risk of COVID? And this could lead to a debate about a Tobin tax, for example, a tax on speculative financial transactions. And maybe we could have a debate about whether such a tax should be enacted to offset a reduction in the payroll tax, for example, which is a tax on ordinary work and labor.
And that's Michael Sandel. He teaches political philosophy at Harvard University. He's written a bunch of books. The newest one, the one we're talking about today on Radio Times, is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. We've got a lot of people that want to join us. I'm going to read some comments and get some listeners in on the conversation. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can always tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a couple of comments and then we'll get some callers on. This is Terry who says, it seems to me that if basic necessities were met, there would would be less racial scapegoating. A comment from Bill, a brief summation of part of what Professor Sandel is saying is that many think they've hit home runs in life when they were born on third base. Let me get some callers in, and we've got Robert waiting very patiently from Philadelphia. Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi, Marty. I hear Michael Sandel saying that the belief that we have a meritocracy is used as a justification for economic inequality and disrespect for working class Americans and America's have-nots by the well-educated, successful haves of our society who take for granted the advantages they were given and disregard the common good. Now, my observation is that when it comes to public policies that would reduce economic inequality and show concern for the common good, and that say you have a right to certain things, regardless of your position in the job market, like health care and child care and higher education and training opportunities and a living wage and labor policies that respect the dignity of work, there's a universal right to those things for the haves and the have-nots. When it comes to those policies, America's white working class and America's white have-nots, especially males, are the demographic group that is least likely to support the political party that advocates those policies. And if that's so, why is that?
Robert's a great question. I'm going to toss that to you, Michael Sandel. We could spend an hour on that, but what do you say?
It is a great question, and Robert has summarized beautifully the theme of the book and the puzzle that the book tries to address. Because if you look, actually, one of the deepest divides in our politics now is along lines of education, of white voters without a college education. In 2016, two-thirds of them voted for Donald Trump, and in 2020, two-thirds of them voted for Donald Trump. And why is this, especially when, as Robert points out, the Democratic Party's agenda of health care and its tax policies would actually benefit this group of working people? Well, one explanation, and perhaps the most familiar explanation, is they're simply these voters. Too many of them are drawn to the racist appeals of Donald Trump's political message. And there is certainly an element of truth to this. But I think, and I argue in the book, that this is not the only factor, which is not to deny it, but it's not the only factor. I think the Democratic Party, by 2016, in virtue of its embrace of the meritocratic rhetoric of rising, had become a party more attuned to the interests and values and outlook of the professional classes, college-educated elites, and had lost touch with or the ability to listen to working-class voters, and as a result, alienated working-class voters. And Robert is right, especially white working class voters, because it did not speak to their condition. And what's interesting is that the same thing happened to the Labour Party in Britain, to the Socialist Party in France. These center-left parties, which traditionally were the voices, the parties looking out for the interests of working class voters, have, during the age of meritocracy, become parties of professional, well-educated classes and have left the way open for right-wing, authoritarian, populist politicians and parties to articulate the grievances, the sense of disempowerment and exclusion of these working-class voters. And I think, although Trump is departed, the challenge for the Democratic Party and for progressive politics generally has not been solved. And that addressing that challenge will depend on finding a way to speak to the sense of humiliation and grievance, the legitimate grievances, not the racist, xenophobic ones, but the legitimate grievances of these working class voters.
Well, and I'm thinking we actually did a whole hour with the Princeton professors who talked about deaths of despair, which has certainly hit some of the population that you talk about.
But I also wonder
whether looking, if we're going to make it about the Democratic Party, if you look at the role that black women played in helping Joe Biden win the White House, frankly, how you see the role that they play, especially when talking about meritocracy?
Well, black women and black voters generally were very strongly supportive of Joe Biden, helping him win the Democratic primaries, as well as winning the presidency. I think we need to see this against the backdrop of the summer of the development and the embrace of the Black Lives Matter movement, which I think is one of the great hopeful movements at a time of rather dark and discouraging politics, because this summer it became a movement, a multiracial, multigenerational movement that I think provided part of the background of support that Joe Biden was able to muster and to mobilize. But what it reveals, bringing it back to your question about how this connects to meritocracy.
Sure. And we have about 30 seconds before our break, but go ahead, Michael Zenda.
This shows, the Black Lives Matter movement shows how much deeper is the problem of racial inequality and injustice than meritocracy, access to college. Police brutality, police violence, the mass incarceration, these are not these sources of racial inequality are not addressed by the rhetoric of rising and meritocracy. They have to be dealt with head on. And I think Joe Biden's departure from reliance on the meritocratic rhetoric of his predecessors helped him appeal to those concerned with racial justice and racial inequalities as such, not simply as tokens of the inability of some people to get into a fancy college.
We're going to get back to our conversation with Michael Sandel after this very short break. Do stay with us. This is Ray.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Go Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Michael Sandel. He teaches political philosophy at Harvard University, and his new book is called The Tyranny of Merit, What Becomes of the Common Good. And again, you can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me read an email from Catherine, and then we'll get Ray to join us. Catherine writes, if we still have a quality public education determined by a child zip code and workers are still laboring at $7.25 an hour, laborers cannot raise families or house families or afford to live in areas that are safe with excellent and safe schools. So we continue with the myth that merit will get you to the top. Let me get Ray from Collegeville to join us on Radio Times. And Ray, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. Thank you very much. Our program. I just have a minor comment. What the gentleman says, it is not true. In Europe, people even don't have an option of the major they want to. And beside U.S. and Canada, there is no country in the world that accepts people coming in here, that accepted in the society. You can live in Europe forever and can never be accepted as a...
You know, Ray, I hate to do this. I appreciate your call. It's not the greatest phone line. I think we got what you're saying. And Michael Sandel, he's saying, look, I'm from Iran. I found success in America, that there are parts of Europe where a person like him might not be accepted, or it would take him maybe generations to be accepted. Is there some truth to that?
Yes, there is. There is a lot of truth to that. On the matter of immigration, generally speaking, we do it better than Europe does. We have a more of a tradition, more of a self-understanding of our country as a nation of immigrants. And that is a powerful ideal. We don't always live up to that ideal fully, as we see in the debates and the fury that surrounds immigration. But on the whole, we do that more successfully than European countries, which is a different dimension of this than we were discussing, and that is to do with class, class rigidities and class mobility. But Ray makes a good point about immigration.
Let me see what Allison from West Philadelphia has to say. And looks like, Allison, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thanks. I really appreciate the author writing this book.
Thanks.
It's something I think about all the time. I grew up with all of the social capital, the, like, parents who went to fancy colleges and the, you know, knowledge and vocabulary to do really well in the SAT and scholarships to private schools. And, but my parents, you know, were sort of barely middle class, and I am here now again, still just scrabbling on the edge of middle class as if maybe it was the money that was the issue in the first place. And I'm sure there are other factors, you know, like ADD is heritable, or like, the things that made my parents low earners probably infected me also. But it's very hard to feel like I did those. I had all those privileges and I still failed.
Don't say fail, Allison. Yeah, hold on. Michael Sandel, go ahead. Allison, stay with us.
I wanted to ask Allison a question, if I might.
Sure.
If you were given one of these surveys that we were discussing earlier in the broadcast, Allison, where they ask people in America, with hard work and effort, it's possible to succeed, or success depends mainly on effort and hard work. How would you have answered that survey?
It's a good question, because I see immigrants do amazing things. And and I know that I didn't work the way that somebody who works in a gas station works. But I know that people of color and lots of other people have systematic disadvantages. But like in my heart, I still think that I like tried hard, and so I should be able to, you know, afford a middle class life. Maybe that's unreasonable.
Well, Allison, I really appreciate the call, and you raised so many poignant and important issues. And I just want to go back to you quickly, Michael Sandel, whether what Allison is describing is that we have a system that just makes it really hard for people to succeed, even as she says, with some of the advantages in life.
Yes. And what Allison's point suggests is that there are structural impediments built into the economy that make it not so, that complicate the story. I guess this might be a way to put it, that complicate the mythic story that in America, all you have to do is work hard and you too will succeed. You too will rise. That myth, that comforting story, doesn't really fit the facts. And I think that facing up to the gap between that myth, that story, and the actual shape of the economy and of opportunity is an important first step to having a broader public debate about how we should reconfigure the economy to make it more inclusive and to provide not only income support and a living wage, which is a starting point, but also social recognition and esteem to working people who may not have a college degree or who may struggle in various ways, but who nonetheless make important contributions to the common good.
Well, and I'm thinking, I mean, where would we be without plumbers and electricians and now these days people who are driving trucks all over the country?
Well, and it goes back in a way to the part of our discussion on education, Marty, because we woefully underinvest. Let me back up. Our system of higher education is the envy of the world, but we woefully underinvest in those forms of learning on which the majority of Americans depend to prepare themselves for the world of work. I'm thinking of state colleges, community colleges, and also vocational and technical training schools and centers. So I think any part of a project that would affirm and renew the dignity of work has to include a massive investment in these forms of learning, and also an elevation of the respect and honor accorded plumbers and nurses and electricians who attend these schools and institutions.
Let me ask you about our political system, such as it is. But there we are. You know, we've got 50-50 in the U.S. Senate, and they're fighting about rules and things that I clearly do not understand. But I worry that our political system is really not up to the task.
I'm afraid I agree with you, Marty. It isn't up to the task for at least a couple of reasons. First, the role of money in politics is a tremendous obstacle to shifting the terms of public discourse and considering the kinds of policies, including tax policies, that we've been discussing. Then there are the rules that you just now referred to, arcane rules, including the filibuster, including, for that matter, the Electoral College, that, as we've seen just in the last election, make it very hard to achieve anything like representative government. And then there's the problem of the lack of political courage and imagination to really raise fundamental questions, including questions about values, which is really what we're talking about.
Well, and there's always that next election that's already started, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I do want to get Harry to join us. Let me read a comment from Sue. She says, more equal salaries would help eliminate the myth of meritocracy. We've got Harry, and Harry is calling us from Philadelphia.
Yes.
Hi, Harry. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'm a person with a disability, and many times knowing a lot of other people with various disabilities, we're set up to fail or dead end employment. The only people that hire the only places that hire a lot of people is the government. The private sector doesn't want to get involved in it. They fight tooth and nail about providing a reasonable accommodation, and you're just set up. There's no promotion. Hmm. Maybe you go up a scale of letters or numbers, and that's it.
Harry, I really appreciate your call to Radio Times raising a whole other issue. Michael Sandel, what do you say?
It's a powerful point.
Yep.
And I think it's a case in point of a society that doesn't fully, because we are so bent on meritocracy and rising and getting into a fancy college as a credential. It's not only seen as a ticket to a well-paying job, it's seen as a source of social prestige. And the hard side of that, the harsh side of it, is that what Harry's describing is really a lack of respect and concern and recognition for everyone in our society who, whatever their talents, their abilities, their disabilities, are nonetheless capable of making contributions that matter to the rest of us. I think the fundamental human need, in the end, is the need to be needed by our fellow citizens and to win social recognition and respect for answering those needs, whatever those needs may be. And this is why I think we need a broader public debate about what counts as a valuable contribution to the common good. We slide easily into the assumption, Marty, that the money people make is the measure of their contribution to the common good. But this is a mistake. The market verdict often gets it wrong. And so I think we should not outsource our moral judgment to markets in deciding about what value, what contributions to the economy and to the common good everyone can make, if only we would respect them and undertake as a society to honor everyone who's capable of contributing.
More empathy, more humility, less hubris?
Well, yes, I think at the heart of the problem, and we began with discussing these changing attitudes towards success, the belief of the successful, that our success is our own doing. This, I think, leads to hubris. I call it meritocratic hubris among the successful. It also leads to demoralization, even humiliation among those who are left behind. So we've been talking here about various policy changes, changing the terms of political rhetoric. But your mention of humility, Marty, suggests, and really one of the central themes of the book, which is that we need a kind of moral and spiritual turning. We need to reconsider the meaning of success. We need to question our meritocratic hubris. Is it my doing that I have the talents that are rewarded in this market society, or is that my good luck? And recognizing the role of luck in life, the role of good fortune, my sense of indebtedness, recognizing these things can prompt a certain humility. There, but for the accident of birth, or the grace of God, or the mystery of fate, go I. The ability to see ourselves in other people's shoes. This is limited. This is diminished if we believe, that if we inhale so deeply of our success that we believe it's all our own doing.
I'm looking at the clock here, but I also read about you were, I think, president of your high school class. This was in California, and you invited Ronald Reagan to come and debate you. I guess talk about hubris, right? And he did come to debate you, but as was written about this incident in your life, he won the day. He won the argument. What did you learn from Ronald Reagan and that that debate experience?
Well, I think he did. I was 18 years old. I was a hubristic high school debater, overly confident of my skills. Everyone in my high school, 2,400 kids, disagreed with Reagan's policies. So I thought it would be fun to debate him and to enable the students to debate him. So he came. I had long hair down to my shoulders, as most of my classmates did. And even my great high school forensic skills didn't really lay a glove on him. He was, I think what he did, he didn't persuade us, but he did seem to respect us. He took us seriously, and he offered his positions, but with a kind of affability, humor, and respect that didn't win us over to his positions, but left us finding it difficult to dislike him. This was in 1971, and 9 years later, he used those same skills to win election as president of the United States with a very conservative agenda that the country probably did not entirely subscribe to. It did teach me about the importance of persuasion. And even as I teach the subject of philosophy, I've always wanted to connect it to the world, to make it a kind of public philosophy, because I think philosophy doesn't just reside in the clouds or in the heavens. It really belongs in the city where citizens gather. And I think part of our challenge is to find our way to a morally more robust kind of public discourse than the kind to which we become accustomed, to address big questions of values. What is a just society? What do we owe one another as citizens? These are questions I think citizens across the political spectrum would like our politics to be about. And the challenge is whether we can manage it.
And that is Michael J. Sandel. His book is The Tyranny of Merit, What's Become of the Common Good. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and thank you for joining us as well.